Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 4th, 2014. You're listening to the best PokerCast ever. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, happy Independence Day for all of our American friends.
Yeah, and what I was thinking is that, obviously, we're in the middle. This is our third of our top five classic episodes that we're freshening up while Chris is in Europe. And since it's July 4th, it almost seems like it should have been our first independent show, right?
Yeah.
Because that was right around July 4th in 08, right? Yeah. When we left the Times and got on our own. And I talked you in somehow into doing this whole Independence Day clip thing that you didn't want to do. It was ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
And I don't remember what we talked about on that show other than we were just so happy to be have quit our jobs and have no money at that point.
Yep.
Which I have no idea why we were that happy at that point. I think it's because we still had vacation time.
Yeah.
Checks stored up, so we hadn't run out of money at that point.
Yep.
So there's probably something that says that we should do that show, but that clearly didn't make our top five and from our listeners. So, but I'm very excited about this show because Mike Faso has always been probably our biggest fan favorite. I can't imagine somebody that are fans from our show that that they love more than Mike. And you know, he just came back to the show last month when I was in Europe. Or 2 months ago when I was in Europe, and people loved it. And it had been 2 years, right?
That's what you said. Yeah, it had been two years.
And he used to be a really frequent guest, you know, because, again, we go back, if you've listened to the last couple shows that we binged on, you know, the show for the first couple years of it was our exit from the boring druthers of work that we were at, right? It was our 1 hour where we'd go up there and just have fun at work. And Basil always loved it. We could drag him up there because he also had a boring job as well, too.
Yeah.
So we'd get him on the show as much as possible. And he always brought it. He always came on and, you know, had this dramatic reading or these jokes. Or he always had all that stuff prepared. He was actually probably more prepared for the show than we have ever
been. Yeah, that's probably true, yep. And it was great because he also was a legend at the Times with us.
True, absolutely.
He had actually given up his job to try to make it as a poker player. And we were just like infatuated with that. And we just thought, wow, we've got to have him on the show to talk about that experience. And then once he was on the show, he was a big hit. And it was like, you know what, he's obviously very dry humor, very smart, and a good guy, a good friend of ours. So let's keep having him back. And people asked for him. And, you know, he was so loved that when the fans got together, Gambit and the guys, and gave us an award for our 100th show. They gave us a nice, beautiful, clear, it was a glass or plastic.
Still on my mantle.
Yeah, Scott, still, I had it for years, and I let him have it now. And it had Faso on it. It said, congratulations, Chris, Scott, and Faso, on your 100th show. You know, because he was really a big part of the show, and it's a shame that he's, you know, gotten away from it, but it's just business as far as, you know, we just can't really line up our schedules all the time, and you know, he can't justify it. Now, it's not like he's getting out of work to do it now. You know what I mean? Now he's got to do it on his own time. So we don't really want to impede on that. So, but huge, huge fan. And this really is my all-time favorite Faso show with you because he had me. I mean, every time he was in the studio, he had us cracking up.
And, oh, yeah, of course.
You know, he did a lot of stuff for us. He did the Who's the Ultimate Ante Up host. Remember we did that? So like the Mythbusters thing. And he came up with all the questions. And so he's always been so entertaining.
Gambling addiction show that everybody hated because of Downer.
Downer.
But I think it's really interesting. I don't know how much I've talked about my friendship with Faso in the shows over the years, probably. But since we have an opportunity here, because I think people might be a little bit surprised by this, but when I started at the Times in 2000, my desk was right next to Faso, and his desk was like we had like a little pod, right, that we're all sitting in. His desk was outside the pod. Like, it's darkened area, had no light there, and he really was a recluse, I thought. He never said anything. He came to work, punched in, put his headphones on, 8 hours, took his lunch pail and left, right?
Yeah.
And so for the first, probably a couple years I was there, I barely ever had a conversation with him.
Right.
Because he just didn't seem like he was interested in talking, and had his headphones on, and it was just, right? So then at some point someone told me, hey, I probably came back from a trip from Vegas or somewhere, and someone said, hey, you know, Fassel quit his job and was a professional poker player for a while. And I'm like, what? This guy that sits here, doesn't talk, is like the most antisocial person ever, was a poker player? So then I, you know, kind of started talking to him about that, and he started opening up, and, you know, we'd have conversations about Reese Witherspoon, who he was in love with back then. And so it was like, it was very slow drip friendship for years, right?
Right.
Until we really started talking about a poker enough that we ended up getting the first home game together, which was hilarious. It was 4-8 limit. And you think about that now. At our home game now, we play 2 skittles, 4 skittles.
Yeah.
Although you guys have been talking about making 3-6, right? Yeah. And we know what we're doing now, right?
Yeah.
Back then, no idea. And, of course, the people that we recruited were, like, people that last played poker in college sometime. So we had this 4-8 game going. It was just hilarious to think that we ever did that. And then eventually kind of morphed into what we had. And then we met you, invited you in, and went from there. So, but the one thing that Fass and I have in common a lot is we both love to travel, like, more than anything else.
Right.
And, you know, he spends, he's one of the people like I was, you know, back when I had a job and I had vacation time. This whole idea of staycation that people do now,
yeah,
ridiculous. Yeah. You know, when I have a day off of vacation, I am out of Florida or out of the air. I'm going somewhere. I'm seeing someplace I haven't seen. And he's the exact same. He still does that. I mean, he's like, hey, we don't have a home game this month. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm in Russia. You're in Russia?
I know.
He just does it all the time, right? So so eventually we decided, hey, let's travel together and go play poker. And I remember our first trip was to Tunica. And this was 2004. I remember that because it was right after Moneymaker won the World Series in 03, right?
Right.
And this was January, and then it was the World Poker Open, which was a huge World Poker Tour event in Tunica then. It's nothing now, I don't think. But we went there with another buddy of our home game, and when that was our first trip, and we got so excited because the room, we walked in the room, and it was just massive, like 70 tables, 80 tables, whatever. You know, eventually I saw the World Series and dwarfs it. But at that point, it was just amazing, right? And Chris Moneymaker was jumping in, sitting, goes, I'm like, yeah, it's Chris Moneymaker, like old fanboys and stuff. And so that kind of started our travels. And then since then, we went to, we did LA, which I know a lot of people were really hoping that was going to be one of the shows with my brutal interview of Eric Seidel. But this, I think you're right, this show is a little bit more fun. And then New York, and I don't know where else we've been together, but really enjoyed traveling with him. And it's funny, as much as I travel now for the business, for some reason I never coordinate with him and get him to go on some of these trips, because I think we would enjoy it still. But
he comes on a lot of our cruises too now.
That's true. Yeah,
he tries to come on the ones that are out of Florida. You know, he'll go to Port Canaveral or definitely Tampa, and so we are seeing the world with him still. It's just, most of the time, it's the same stops that we've seen him with him before. But he, you know, he's just always been a good friend. He's always at the home games, and he used to host home game for a little while there. It got a little difficult with his schedule now, but you know, it's great that you guys got together like that, and it just ultimately bled into all of our lives too. And now we're all just friends, and it's great because when we were at the Times, he would come by my desk, and he'd always run a hand by me that. And he's like, all right, I'm in the third seed, you know, and it was fun. It was that 20 minutes a day, or, you know, I would tell him about something happened to me online, or he would tell me something happened at Derby Lane or whatever. And it was so cool. You know, we got to just hang out and visit and talk about hands and stuff. And that's when he really opened up. Once he realized all of us liked poker and we were all good at it and we all enjoyed our home game, that he, you know, that's when he really opened up and became.
Yeah, you got to pierce that Teflon outer edge.
Yeah.
And when you get in, it's really cool. So I know you have a couple things you want to talk about this show. So I'll just the one thing I want to say is that it's funny because I ride you all the time and my wife all the time that you guys are the exact same person.
Yeah.
You know, the same things that that annoy you that I annoy you with,
right,
the same things that I know Laura with. And the same thing that you do that noise the heck out of me. She does the same thing. So it's funny that I'm like, I just can't get away from either one of you, you know. But in this case, this was one of those things where I think Faso was like my wife and did some of the same things that she gets on at me about. And that's not usually the case, but in this one, I think there for folks that know my wife and I together, you'll see some similarities in the fights that we have with some of the stuff that happened in this episode.
Well, let me ask you a question. A lot of people remind you of your wife. Did you ever think that we're all normal and you're the weirdo?
I'm not the weirdo, although my wife now just came into the office and is giving me this dirty look. So, no, I am absolutely spot on, not weird at all. I'm living in this collection of knuckleheads.
I'm sure. Well, the other thing I wanted to say was my favorite thing about this episode is just how obtuse you were with the Border Patrol. I mean, really, how could you not grasp the levity and the gravity of the situation? I mean, to me, it was like, dude, clearly just tell this guy what you need to tell him and move on. And how could you not? It's 2006. I mean, you know, it's still relatively fresh in our minds that there's terrorism out there and that's why they're stopping you and being so strict. And when Faso did his impression of you, I mean, he always did good impressions. You know, I mean, that was one of his things. He did a lot of funny impressions. But when he was doing, when you hear him making fun of you, it's just like, it's literally, this is my favorite episode with you two. I mean, there are a lot of times L.A. and you totally dropping the ball on that interview and stuff. But, I mean, this was just classic. And I'm so glad that people picked this one. A lot of people picked a lot of the Faso shows, but this one, by hands down, was the one they wanted to hear the most. So I guess without further ado, here we go. This is October 19th, 2006. Scott and Faso go to Niagara Falls.
To you from the studio of the St. Petersburg Times, it's Annie Up, the weekly poker podcast. This is show 71. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And brother, can you spare a dime?
I think we know what that means.
No, well, dramatic reading today, though, right?
No.
But Mike is back because you guys went to the Great White North, and we'll be talking about that a little later on the show. Glad to see you're back safe, guys.
Yeah, they had snow up there. And
what is that, actually? I forgot.
Most of it was gray by the time we left and little clumps all over the place.
Wow.
It was very exciting to see that. Actually, it was nice to get out of the sweltering heat down here and up into the cool weather of Western New York.
It was probably the nicest weekend we've had here in a long time. It was in the low 80s, no humidity.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, it was perfect weekend.
It didn't quite hit the 80s up there.
No.
Maybe if you add up every day's temperature. But we did get home a lot quicker than I thought because our wallets were lighter, so the plane could travel a lot faster. But more about that later.
Yeah, and did you guys have a delay, though? I thought I heard you had a delay.
We had a delay there. We had a delay back.
You know, I figured. It's weather.
Or, you know.
All right, so let's think about talking about the apes here, because it seems like so long ago. You know, we occasionally we had the Thursday Saturday one, so it's kind of still fresh. But I almost forgot that we even had the apes tournament.
Ah, you can't forget about the apes.
Of course, how could I forget?
Not before Pot Limit Omaha High Low. I'm getting dangerously close to having a big goose egg at the end of apes.
Yeah, guys, what's going on with you? I mean,
I just
no
missed
points.
The stud high low, I just missed the final table. I came in 11th in another one. I'm just not being I haven't been able to close the deal yet.
Yeah, you guys. This
and
is
Omaha high low pot limit is not one of my. It's probably my third best game, so we'll have to see how it goes tonight.
You guys are going to have to come 1-2 in horse, I think, for you to have a chance of doing anything.
Oh, I'm already counting on that, so that's why I'm scared. I need more than that.
Yeah, that's not good. Well, anyway, our winner, and I guess it's Jay Hazen, right? It was probably Jason.
We're not known for our pronunciations on this show.
Well, we'll let him say it, because you know what? He called in.
Very good.
To give us his impressions, and so let's listen to that.
Hey, Annie Uppers. It's John Hazen from San Jose, California. I'm your lucky winner of Apes event number 6, the 7 stud, 8 or better. And just wanted to say how much I've been enjoying the show, and I'm getting caught up on back episodes. Been listening for about a month. I really enjoy it and looking forward to getting to know you all better and competing with you again next week in the Omaha High-Low. So have a great week, and see you at the tables.
All right. So
always nice when the winners call.
Yeah, it's very good. And when we send the banana, you know, make sure you send in that photo.
Yeah.
Put it on our gallery.
Exactly.
So how did you guys meet your demise? Do you remember?
Yeah, Gambit.
yours was great. I was at that table.
You went out pretty early, didn't you?
I went out way too early. I was like James Dean. yeah, you know, I had three jacks, and Gambit had three queens. And, you know, as much as I tried to reorder the cards, you know, I ended up with just three jacks.
Man.
And, of course, no low. And boom, yeah. Gone.
Boom,
just like
gone,
that.
Just like that.
And there's nothing worse than when you get booted like that in a tournament that you have such high hopes for. I mean, in No Limit, yeah, you know. Boom, I'm gone. That's fine. And
yeah.
I expected it. But that tournament, I thought I was going to go far. And when you look down and you see all in and no chips there, then that little gray bar comes up. You finished in 1,068th place. It hurts.
And then they make you have to click OK to get out of the screen.
That's right. They do.
I just want to do a control Q and turn my computer off, but it won't let me go off until I say okay that I've finished out of the money yet again. I hate that thing.
I wonder if it's like a running joke with the IT geeks at Full Tilt Poker, where they like time how long it takes for you to push okay and how long you've gone out. Then they just sit there and laugh because they know you're just in stunned silence at your house or whatever.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Well, I did a lot better than Scott, but
I think everybody did a lot better than me, but
I ran into some problems with some hands, and I don't remember the exact hand I went out on, but there was a theme of my demise that had to do with a trouble hand in stud eight or better, which is the wicked three low with a pair starting hand.
Yes.
Like 4-4-6 or something.
Yeah.
And it's one of those in-between type hands that you'd rather be pairing on 5th, 6th, or 7th, or two-pairing, than starting with the pair. Yet it's a playable hand, I have to believe.
Yeah.
But I got into a couple hands like that where I had to go to the river and didn't catch. That was pretty much the story of my demise, those troublesome low one-pair hands.
Yeah, I think that for the first time I actually could play this game this week, or this time, and seeing, all right, I think this guy's going high. And it happened, the hand I went out, and I thought he was going high, and it was the one time I misjudged.
Mm.
And I was going low, and he caught a low on the river, and I think, I think he told me 6th Street, I can't remember, but anyway, he caught the low, and I was going low, and he made like a 7-5, and I made a 7-6, and I was out. But I really enjoyed myself. I could not believe I was around after the second or third break. I'm like, I'm still playing. I can't believe this.
I was surprised, too. And when I
You must have had some real fish at your table.
No.
You were at my table.
When I looked in a couple times at Chris, I was very impressed at how he was playing that game, which he had never really played before.
We've had a lot of beginner's luck in this tournament so far.
Yeah.
A lot of people playing new games and running the table.
I think we're creating a whole new seven-card stud nation here.
And Raz and everything out. Pretty soon all the games are going to dry up. We're not going to be able to beat anything anymore.
Yeah, you know, and I think on one of the forums, I think it was El Snorfo, but someone had mentioned that they played in a Raz tournament the other night, $3,000 guaranteed tournament, right?
They had one of those the day before we left to New York.
And he finished like in fourth or third, and he just basically said, thanks to the Annie Up Nation for introducing me to this game. I would have never played or known how to play if it wasn't for that. And I think that's what we're doing. I think we're opening our eyes up to other games, and they're enjoying poker even more and now making money because of it. So I think it's great. But I really enjoyed myself, you know, in this tournament. And I'm looking forward to tonight's game. For those of you who don't realize, you know, we're taping a day later. and if you don't, if you're looking for tips, they're from last week. Scott gave his tips last week on Split Games and Pot Limit Omaha High-Low. So I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
Any predictions tonight?
I really don't play any hands that I'm not drawing to the nuts in this game. So
smart. Who'd you have heard that from?
I'm either going to do very well or bust out early.
How about a turnout? Any kind of prediction on
that? Oh.
No, I'm just wondering now. That's what we're thinking about.
How many do we get for the stud 8? 70? 40 to
50. Was it most?
72, 70? I think.
For stud high-low?
Something like that.
Well, that's pretty good turnout.
Not bad.
I think. Yeah. I think we'll probably do at least that or better in this one.
Well, for their last pot limit, I think it was 60-something or 80-something.
Yeah.
So
I'm
going to guess 72 people tonight.
72.
Yeah.
All right. You're going to force me into an over and under on this one. I'm gonna say over just because I'm an optimistic kind of guy.
Okay. You know, you
I don't like to bet against the Any Up Nation.
I'm very disappointed, though, because you still haven't worn that Goldilocks.
Yeah, well, you know, the dry cleaners, they ruined it, you know? You can't trust them.
No, no, no. You were in the honeymoon suite at Niagara Falls, and it's probably still in your suitcase, isn't it? All right, so we have some business to take care of with the one-minute mystery.
Yes, right? We do.
Let's move on to that. Now, this is going to be the first clip to refresh what we learned last week. So, you know, I can't remember it either. I don't know why, but I'm going to have to let it refresh.
You know, and I heard an interesting, read an interesting article about Peter Falk when he started the Columbo series.
Oh, yeah.
Did you read that too?
He picked out the uniform.
Yeah,
the outfit.
He didn't like the outfit. He didn't like the car they gave him. He wanted to do it all himself and dumb it down a little bit, make it look more authentic, and that's how it got started.
I think the headline was Columbo really is Falk or something like that. But he also went out and picked out the car in the back lot, and when he found it, it had a flat tire, and he said, that's perfect. That's got to be the car. And now I think someone
You know, and I think the license plate, too, was 6-6.
Someone sent us an email, too, that he was speaking somewhere or something, and they were going to listen to him talk to some school or something. So he's everywhere.
He's everywhere. Excellent. All right,
let's listen to part one.
Greetings. This is Columbo from hookerwannabe.blogspot.com, and this is yet another one-minute mystery. The Case of the Haunted Country Club. It's a three-table home game multi-table tournament. We are on about level 5, and I'm about average in chips. Most of the players are tight weak, with a few, including the player on my left, tight aggressive. The blinds now are 20-40, and I have about 700 in chips. We are playing eight-handed at this table.
All right, now listen to me. This is only going to take 10 minutes, you hear me? So I want you to keep your trap shut, and I want you to behave yourself.
I'm in the big blind now, and something out of the ordinary happens. The under-the-gun player on my left makes it 2x to go. This otherwise normal pre-flop table has gone very tight, and it's folded around to the button, who calls.
I don't understand. There's nothing here.
Now the small blind folds, and I figure I can pop it here with a decent hand, but I look down at 5-7 off. Now I think about a moment, but I decide just to call, and I'm getting the right price. I'm not going to try and play this away from the button in an under-the-gun razor with 5-7 off. But I will see a half-price flop.
Does that work?
I know I'm first to act of the flop, so as it's being dealt, I'm thinking to myself, what kind of cards do I want to see on this board with a 5-7? As it turns out, I get the ultimate mixed bag. 2-5-7, all clubs.
I'm afraid I'm going to need your assistance. I hope you don't mind.
I am staring down at my two-paired on the all-country club board, and it's my action. What am I going to do?
I think I talked about this last time. It's always dangerous when you have two baby pair and you got somebody raising under the gun like that because you can over a pair. And
yeah, you can get counterfeited very easily.
If a deuce comes, he's got aces or tens
or
whatever.
Well, it's helpful that he's got a top two pair, though, as weak as they are.
You're right. But I'm just saying, if he has an over pair to that and a deuce pairs, you know, he's in a lot of trouble. Plus, if you have an over pair with a club in your hand, he's going to make the nut flush if it comes. So, I don't know. I think that you want to keep this pot small. I think, especially if he said the under the gun was, he said it was tight aggressive. So if he's bringing it in for a raise and he's aggressive, he may push after this. If he's got a club in his hand, he's got a high pair. So my intention is to keep the pot small, maybe bet half the pot. But
interesting.
And then, trying to force somebody out with this hand?
And then get away from it if you're re-raised.
Yeah, because he said he had average stacks.
Why would you want to go broke on a board like that with two little pair?
Right.
Basically,
somebody could already have the flush. Somebody could have the nut flush draw. Somebody could have an over pair and isn't going to be afraid of your 5-7, you know, and you get in trouble there. So I think keeping the pot
small is a good idea.
That's what I'm thinking. What about you, Scott? You seem to disagree a little bit.
Well, no, I originally thought I'd like to put out a fairly decent-sized bet just to...
How about an over bet?
See, an over bet that I think you guys are getting into what you're concerned about is getting pot committed that you're not sure where you are. But I don't know. I guess a small bet, all it's going to do is keep you from losing a lot of money. I don't know if it's going to...
Well, how about
it's
this?
It's not going to take down the pot. It's not going to really give you much information.
You make the small bet. If you get one of the two to fold, that's you've done well.
Now your head's up.
And then you can still get away from the hand.
Sure.
If another club comes another on the turn, or if you're check raised, or if you make another medium sized bet and he gives you a big raise.
Now, when you saw a small bet, what are you thinking here? I mean, we don't have any figures here.
He said half pot.
Yeah, I was thinking half the pot. So if there's 2, 4, 6, there's like 7 big bets in there about.
Yeah, because I'm thinking the pot's not very big as it is now.
Right. 3 or 4 bets, maybe 4 bets.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure what you really lose by going the full 7 bets, the pot size.
Yeah, maybe. I guess so. I mean, that's true, too. I guess it just depends on the size.
I mean, obviously, you're screaming that you don't have clubs in your hand and you want people to go away. So, you know, I guess a smart player is going to.
Well, if you overbet, you're screaming that, I think. If you bet normal.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay. So,
But, I mean, we're talking about tight players here, he said. I mean, even tight aggressive, I think.
Yeah.
Don't like to get into those big pots.
Well, my fear is this guy's got, like, he's got, like, queens or kings with a club or ace king, and one of them's a club. And so I want to see what he's going to do.
Is the small bet going to tell you anything about that? You're just keep trying to keep the pot small and hope you can check this down and win.
I think that if he has an overpair and doesn't have a club, a small bet would make him re-raise me, and then I'll know where I am. I don't know. I'm thinking I still want to keep this a small pot. I don't want to check, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, who would ever check a flush draw?
All right, let's see what happened.
Welcome back.
Could you explain this?
Based on this table and whatever logic I can muster, I need to scare my opponents from playing or drawing on this flop. Each of them may well have a club, and someone might have the ace of clubs. But a lesser club is a great decision, and I want them to think really hard about it.
That's a very big problem, sir.
It seems that it's poker 101 to bet here, but I have another plan. I have a reasonable expectation that two pair may be currently ahead. But if there's a lot of heat from the two other players, I still want the option to bail out. What I'm going to do is set up a check raise here. I'm going to try and trap a pot stabber or a low to mid club draw with a big raise he can't call. I'll risk they'll both check, but I think somebody will stab at it.
All that work to get in here, you think you'd try and take something.
So I check, and the end of the gun tight aggressive player bets out a half pot size bet. The button folds, confirming that I am not involved against any huge monsters in the closet. I check-raise the new total pot size, and he instantly folds.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
I made him pay dearly for his stab at the pot on a very dangerous board. A quick episode, to say the least. 10 minutes later, I get queen-queen after it's folded around to me in the small blind. He re-raises me with his hand visibly shaking. I figure he has ace-ace or king-king, but can't resist seeing the flop with a pair of queens. When the flop comes 3 undercards, I check as I expect him to go all in here no matter what, and he doesn't disappoint me. Assuming equal stack sizes and knowing the history of the last clash with this player, would you call this bet, or would you fold it? Me, I folded it. Only ace-ace or king-king made sense to me here, but he never showed his cards, and thus, that won't be an episode.
That's just stupid. Sorry.
Until next time, this is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com saying that you can disguise your hand, but not your handshake.
So what do you think?
Check raise. I hadn't thought about that. It gets away from what you guys are saying, though. I mean, obviously, you're getting yourself pot committed, so it's a risk.
Well, the problem, too, is that a check raise doesn't give you any information. I mean, you check, and now this guy bets at it. Is he betting at it to protect his hand, or is he betting at it to stab at it? You know, I mean, this could have been an easy example where the guy could have come over the top after he check raised him.
Exactly.
You know, I just think that it's a mistake to not get any information at all on this hand until he takes a stab at it. I don't know. He worked for him, and that's fine, but he easily could have gone the other way.
Remember, he had two people that could have taken a stab at it. He didn't expect both to, but
right.
He thought the odds were good that one or the other would.
So, yeah, I mean, you're going to do the continuation thing, but he could have easily had aces with an ace of clubs, you know, or ace king with ace of clubs, or and already had the flush, and just trying not to lose you by betting, because it looks fishy. If you raise preflop, three babies come, and you don't bet. It looks kind of fishy, so he's got to bet anyway, even if he has aces. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it worked for him, and that's great, but I just think it could have easily gone the other way for him.
But, as most hands can.
Exactly. Exactly.
If not, we wouldn't have a show.
All right, let's move on to our main topic.
This is Jean Cosenza, and you're listening to Annie Up, and you are feeding Christopher Cosenza's ego.
All right, I'm real excited. You guys went away. You got into the Great White North. Got a little cold. Saw, you know, a couple of honeymoon spots. What happened? How do we want to do this? You want to break it down by casino? Do you want to just let it roll and just start talking?
Just fire some questions at us and we'll fill it in. And I know Mike is he feverishly was scratching notes the entire week.
Well, the first thing I want to know is
my brain is a little more advanced than that.
What were the names of the casinos you went to?
All right, the casinos were the Falls View.
Okay.
In Niagara, Canada.
Okay.
And the Niagara Casino in Niagara, Canada.
Okay.
And they're both owned by the same company, we found out.
And the third one up there is the Seneca Casino, which is in New York.
Okay.
On the other side.
Did you guys rented a car and then had to keep going over the border and all that? Was that it?
Yeah. Let me just explain something about Scott. I guess Scott hasn't really crossed a lot of international boundaries in his lifetime. We get to the border going into Canada, and we have our passports ready, and Scott's all like, hey, how's it going? Good afternoon. And he's like, it's a toll booth. And I said, like, you know, this is an international boundary in a time of terror. This is not like the entrance to the funhouse at the state fair, all right? So you need to just dial it back a little bit on your little glad-handing with the customs guy.
Glad-handing.
It's like, hey, how you doing? And the guy's like, what country are you from? I mean, he's all business. So that's what he should be doing.
Right.
And Scott says, U.S. And he said, where are you going? And Scott said, we're going to our hotel. And he said, what are you doing up here? And Scott said, visiting.
We were.
And so the guy said, who are you visiting? He said, just visiting.
We were.
And he said, what do you mean? And I had to lean my head down because Scott was driving and I was in the passenger seat. I leaned my head down and looked up at the guy and I said, we're going to play poker over at the casinos. I finally had to just spell it out what we were doing up there. Because if it was up to Scott, we would have been there forever.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it was unbelievable what Scott was. And then later the guy says, so what do you do? And Scott goes, huh? He says, what do you do? And Scott, huh? And I said, Scott, he's asking you what you do for a living. Scott had a lot of trouble at the border.
All right, let me try to defend myself here. All right,
you can try.
The last time I crossed the border into Canada, it was in Detroit going to Windsor for a Packers-Lions game. My brother and I went up there, and we got freaking Betty Crocker hey, coming up for the game, hey, great, have fun, see ya.
Was that pre or post 2001?
Of course it was pre 2001.
Well, I mean, what do you expect?
Well, yeah. 2001 was 5 years ago. I'm trying to forget. So this time, you know, I get freaking Detective Sipowicz there.
No, it was the same situation.
Turns his chair around and shines a light on me, and
we had the
I was
same,
supposed to, you know, quickly react to it.
We had the same
Canada
situation every time. About 8 border crossings, and each time it was the same demeanor of the customs or the border inspector. And each time Scott didn't understand that you just answer the questions directly and simply and go get on with it.
Oh, my God.
He's in there fumbling around like, I don't know why, but what do you mean? What do I do?
So you stayed at the casinos?
No, we stayed at a place on the Canadian side that was about a mile.
Glengate Hotel, Stanley Avenue, sir.
How far were the two Canadian casinos from each other?
A brisk walk.
They were that close.
They weren't that close.
They were not that close.
No. Oh, okay.
It's about a 20-minute walk.
Oh, okay. But they're still in the vicinity.
Which we took.
We took.
Because we're idiots.
No, I actually enjoyed walking in the brisk night air because after you've been sitting for hours and hours, it's good to get out and walk around.
What was it, like 30s?
It was brisk, baby.
30 degrees?
No, it was in the 40s.
40s. Well, that's not too bad.
A little wind coming off of the, you know,
Niagara River
the
is what
falls.
It's called. Yeah, and that's the other thing. There's a little natural attraction up there called the Niagara Falls.
So I think I've heard of that.
We're darting back and forth across the bridge, the Friendship Bridge, I believe it was.
Yes, the Friendship Bridge.
And
The Rainbow Bridge.
The Rainbow Bridge.
Yeah, yeah. The Friendship Bridge is here in Tampa on the Gandy, or Pinellas.
And so as we're driving by, I say, hey, look over there to your right, Scott. See that? That's the falls. And he's like driving like hell to get to the casino. I says, oh, yeah, that's nice. So it looks like just like a lot of water falling off a cliff. So anyway, we went to those three casinos.
Which one did you go to first?
Niagara Casino.
No, we went to Falls View first, and then we walked to Niagara.
You guys want to get your story straight? You want to go out in the hall and talk about it a little bit before we get going?
Well, here's a summary of what the rooms are up there. You've got the Falls View, which is the sort of the nicest casino up there. Yes. And it has a...
Kind of like a Canadian version of Bellagio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but not as nice as Bellagio by a long stretch.
Yeah, but it's a Canadian version.
It was too nice.
So it's understood that it's not as nice.
Oh, no.
The Niagara Casino is sort of like the, I don't know, what would you call it? The horseshoe of poker rooms?
Yeah, it didn't have quite the character of the horseshoe, but yeah, it's been there. It's been around the block.
And then the Seneca is a nice room. It looks like they've redone it since I was up there last, and it's a standard poker room, but it's pretty good sized, and they run tournaments and stuff up there. So of the three, we had trouble finding games because everything was hold'em and everything was no limit.
Yeah, these Canadians, they don't like the limit game.
Wow.
I have a feeling that you've got a little Canadian blood in you.
So we found, the first day, we found a 1-2 no limit game that I did pretty well at.
I did not.
And I just kept...
Shocker.
It never ceased to amaze me what people thought were good hands in these showdowns.
Wow.
I have a pretty good idea, I think, about what a good hand is, but it is like light years ahead of what other people think monsters are. So my strategy on that was just to sit and wait for a big hand and get paid off, which I did. But I didn't win that much, but I did all right.
That was my strategy too. I never hit a big hand.
Did you sit at the same table?
No. Not in the 1-2 game, no.
That's smart.
So then we finally found a limit game at the Falls View, and it's the 5-10 limit. So 5-10 Canadian is kind of like,
you know, 1-2 American.
No, it's like it's like about 4-9 or 4-8 US.
Okay.
So that's a good level for me. Yeah.
It's an excellent level. Actually, I like the 5-10 a lot. Red chip game.
It was a good game, and they had a $2 small blind, which was nice that you could get away from that.
Yeah.
So it's $7 every 10 hands, 70 cents a hand, and I enjoyed that game a lot.
I was a winner in that game.
Yeah,
both sessions.
Scott crushed that game. He just crushed it.
It was just too bad that it took us 9 hours to get on that table every time.
Yeah, there's one limit table in the whole room.
Man.
And everything else is 1-2, 2-5, 5-10, they have a 5-5 no limit. And
at 10-25 no limit too.
And then at Niagara, it was either 1-2 no limit or 2-4 limit. And I agreed with Scott. There was no way, unless it was the final last resort, I was going to get into a 2-4 game.
Right.
But limit, I mean. And then we found what I consider to be my real home at this trip was table 4 at the Seneca Casino. The 7-card
stud. Player in, table 4.
The 7-card stud 1-5 spread limit game with some of the old guys. Some of the old paisans and some of the old New York wise guys. And we called over there and said, because we were still on the Canadian side, so we called her and said to the girl at the desk, you got that stud game going yet? And she said, well, not yet, but there's a bus coming in 20 minutes, so we should be getting started soon. And sure enough, by the time we got over there, that table was full, man. And they were
not going anywhere.
No.
To their
I had more fun playing stud at that table than anything else in the entire trip. And just to give you an idea, there's a guy there. We sit down, and these old guys are bantering and telling jokes and stuff. And the guy goes, hey, Frank, did you know diarrhea is hereditary? And the guy goes, no. He says, yeah, it runs in your genes.
Oh, my God.
So those are the kind of wise guys and paisans that we had up there, and it was a lot of fun, man. And the funniest thing was, Scott was sitting there. We were both rocks. I mean, total rock. But the old rocks, the crusty old rocks, were complaining that Scott was playing too tight.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's when I knew that my wife is correct and that I've already reached old mandom.
Old mandom.
When a guy who is 76 and a widow is calling me a rock at a table.
So now, who got to sit down first? Because I'm assuming two seats didn't open up at once.
Well, we alternated.
Yeah, so we did.
Once, if we got there and had a wait list, Scott would go on the list first, okay. And then the next time I'd go on the list.
It's a little system we have.
Hey, that's really good. Yeah. Well, you know, married couples have these kind of things, so...
Normally, it doesn't take 3 freaking hours to get on a table anywhere we've been. That's painful, though. In fact, the very first day in town, we didn't wager a nickel on anything.
Wow.
We were in bed at 9:30 on Saturday.
Yeah. Saturday, wow. We got in.
It was impossible to get on a table anywhere.
And so we just went to bed. Of course, since we went to bed at like 9:30, the next morning at 6 o'clock, I pop up. But that's a tip, too, that I've found is helpful. If you're going on these poker trips, sometimes that is the best way to do it, because to get up in the morning when they're just starting to open up the tables, you're sure to getting a seat. That's the best way to do it, rather than trying to get in at 8 o'clock at night as you're locked out.
Now, my favorite part of going to sleep at 9:30, which is also part of old mandom, was your story. We wake up in the morning, I get a good night's sleep, I wake up at 6 too, I'm all ready to go, and Mike tells me that he was up a little bit earlier than 6.
Yeah. Went to bed about 9:30.
P.M.
P.M. I fall asleep, and then I wake up, and I say, I guess it's time to go play poker. I hope some of these rooms have, you know, tables going at this hour. I'm like, and I'll stretch, and I look over at the clock, and it's 10:40 at night. I've been asleep for an hour. At which point I said, oh, hell.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to have to go back to sleep.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, so I eventually got back to sleep, and we got into the – I liked the stud game at the Seneca.
Yeah,
and we played a couple tournaments, too.
You spent about 12 straight hours
Tuesday. I really got to know that game very well. It was on life support a couple times. We had it down to three-handed.
Wow.
And then you ended up heads up with the poor old lady taking the Social Security money.
That is the saddest thing
I've ever seen in my
life. I was so desperate. I was playing heads up with this little old lady until I busted her.
Oh, no. Now, you were desperate to win money.
Some poor little kid's not getting a Christmas gift now.
Desperate to keep the game going.
Oh, my God.
And to win money.
So when you busted her out, you're sitting there all by yourself at the table.
Well, at that point, they had a sit-and-go starting, which I played in.
Okay, so how'd you do in the tournaments, and how many did you play in?
Tournaments were, what's the best word, frustrating?
Yeah, Scott went out on the bubble quite a bit. We both made a final table but didn't cash, and it was...
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, between us, we played...
four or five.
Six tournaments, and we made...
zero.
Four final tables. Of course, one was a sit-and-go, so you automatically made the final table. But no, we made three final tables on them. We both made the final table of the night tournament, which was a very interesting tournament that we'll tell our listeners about. It is a convert to cash tournament. So it was a $30 or $35 buy-in. You got one $30 rebuy in the first hour. And then at the end of the hour, you could add on for $30 to $40, depending whether you wanted to give a deal or token or not, to get more chips. So if you go the whole way out, it's $105.
$105 was the total.
And then you play down to the final table, and then they use a percentage of the prize pool. They take $400 out, and in this tournament, they took $400 out of the prize pool and made that a prize fund. Took the rest of the money and redistributed it proportionally to everybody at the final table based on your chip count.
Wow.
They gave you actual
real money chips. Yeah.
And then at the beginning of every round, if you were the short stack, you could get up and walk away from the table with your chips.
Wow.
And so, there was no finish. You just keep playing until somebody had all the chips at the table or somebody cut a deal.
So the blind started at 1-1.
1-1.
With the real money chips.
Right.
And then they went to 1-2, 2-4. They geometrically accelerated. So by the time I got out, it was at 16-32.
Okay, so you guys made that final table?
Yeah. Made that final table and walked away nothing. No.
Oh, so you just played with your chips.
I had the option of picking up and
leaving.
We both
did.
with my
and we both said screw it
with my real money chips at the beginning of the round, right before the new blinds went up.
But this is an interesting thing. I wonder what our listeners will say about this, because I was the short stack on the final table, which one of the, it's great because in the tournament chips I had maybe 5 big bets left at the break, if that. They convert to the casino chips, and I get $43, and the blinds are 1-1. So now all of a sudden I have 43 big bets.
Yeah.
And I'm the short stack, so I could have walked away from 43. I didn't have to rebuy, so I was only stuck 75. So I could have taken half a loss on my money and walked right away. But with blinds at 1-1, it seemed silly to. In fact, everybody there was a regular that said no one ever walks away on the first one.
Right.
You know, I might as well stick around for a level or two and see if either I can double up or get something going.
Wow.
That's so I had the option on 3 straight levels. I was perpetually the short stack. I couldn't get anything going. And finally, the last option, I had 30 left, and I decided to play at that point with blinds at, I think, 4-8 or something.
Wow. I've never heard of that.
Eventually went bust.
That's pretty
cool. But Faso made it to, what, 5th place, correct?
Yeah, I was in 5th.
And you had an option to walk away with $102, right?
Right.
So a $3 loss.
And the blinds were going to go up. And looking back, I would have been better off to pick up at that point and just cash out my chips instead of try to hit a hand.
In hindsight.
With the
but here's
blind.
The situation. As soon as Faso got booted out, they carved up the rest of the money.
Yeah, they just did a chop.
So you get to that point in the tournament. Are you willing to take a $3 loss on your investment, but have $102 in your pocket, or stay in the game and take a shot that the next person's out and you can carve up all this money that's left?
The blinds at that point was 15-30 or something, so I didn't have a lot of play left.
Right.
So that made me think later that it would have been better off to pick up and just get my 100 back and not take a stab, because at that point, even though I was on the button or near it, you're only going to see 5 or 6 hands tops.
Right.
And I didn't catch anything, so I busted out.
Tough call, though.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it's a concept that I hadn't seen before. And,
yeah,
that's
interesting. Yeah, very intriguing.
It puts a decision to the short stack every time the blinds go up.
That is so weird.
Yeah.
Now, they run a lot of interesting tournaments, too. I played in one on Tuesday night when I was just finally got hammered at the stud game that Faso locked me into. I was stuck more than I've ever been stuck in a game in my life, and they were running a $120 tournament that night. No rebuys, freeze out, but 2,000 starting chips and 20-minute levels, and the levels were good. Quarter-quarter, quarter-50. 50-75.
Yeah, they did a lot of that
2/3
level stuff.
There. Yeah, so they
this
didn't
was
get high.
Seneca, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. So I was figuring I was going to get at least a good hour of a good play out of that tournament, even though it was a tournament buy-in that's a little higher than I normally do.
Right.
And then I turned out making the final table, top 6 cash, and I go out 7th.
Oh, brutal. 288
for 6.
Ah, brutal.
Missed it just like that.
That's just brutal.
But that's a great tournament. I played for, what, 2.5-3 hours in that thing?
Yeah, it was a long time because I was over there trying to keep that stud game going.
Busting granny.
We needed another bus to come in. At
Whistler's mothers.
There was an interesting story in one of these tournaments. You know, if you're ever in a card room for very long, you always will run into characters and funny situations that you never see online or anything like this. There was a guy... I'll call him Mario. I'm not sure that was his name.
That was his name, yes.
An Italian-American gentleman, and Chris and I are both that...
Persuasion.
Yeah.
So this rebuy tournament that we were talking about earlier, you get one rebuy, and they come by, and they initial your receipt when you've taken the rebuy. And then...
kind of a lame way of doing it, I think. That's the only thing I didn't like about that.
You know, that's
how they ran tournaments there.
Yeah, I don't know how else.
But the one in the Sahara, you keep your seat card until you rebuy.
And then you just give it up.
You give your seat card
then.
Yeah,
that makes
sense.
There's
no reason to give up your seat card until you're out of the tournament.
So this guy does a rebuy and comes over and she gives him his 600 extra chips and he gives her $30. And the guy across from him says, "You've already rebought." And the guy says, "No, I didn't rebuy." And he says, yes, you did. I remember because she came over before and she said, let me see your receipt. And he says, and he's like patting his pockets and stuff. Yeah. Says, I can't find it right. I'll come back and you can sign it. And so, the guy says, yeah, I remember you rebought. You can't rebuy twice. And, then that sets him off. And he says, you mind your own business. You come to Italy. You start minding other people's business. You see what happens to you there. And the guy says, so you mean you're telling me everybody's dishonest in Italy? And the guy says, I'd like to see you move to Italy and try that. He says, well, we're going to go upstairs and look at the film and see what you did. If you did the rebuy, they're going to know it. And so, but he went on and on. And they finally gave him the rebuy. They went upstairs. They checked the film. They found out he already had done the rebuy.
Oh my God!
They ejected him from the casino on a 24-hour ban. At Seneca, if you do something wrong, there are two levels. You can either get thrown out for 24 hours or a year.
Those
are the two. Those are the two. And people were saying nobody's going to respect Mario anymore. I don't care that he's only expelled for 24 hours. Nobody will ever look at him the same again.
Oh my God!
So he moves to another table while he's still in the tournament, and then he busts out. He doesn't cash, and he comes over to the guy who was telling him that he'd already rebuy. Says, "I busted out, and I did rebuy again, and you stink." And it's like. So we were calling it Rebuy Gate.
This is the thing I love about that story. I mean, what is this guy trying to prove? One, you're putting more money into this tournament than you should. And it's not like they're not going to find out. And if he does win, they're going to take the money away from him. So why even try it? But I'll tell you, that tournament... Full Tilt has nothing on what happened to me in this tournament.
Really?
It was the most brutal
crushing
of someone's dreams ever in a tournament. I had three of a kind, three hands in a row, lost all three, and was out.
Oh, my God.
In a rebuy tournament. First hand crippled me, second hand I went out, I rebought, next hand I'm all in, out. Oh. Two of them were aces. I had ace 10 offsuit. In late position, called. Flop came two aces. Get all the money in with somebody who had ace five.
Oh,
rivers of five. I'm crippled. Next hand, I get pocket aces. Money goes all in. And I think I lose to flop a set, and I didn't quite slow play too much. I mean, I got some money in on the flop. On the turn, he picks up both a flush and a straight draw, and he rivers a straight. I don't know. Out. You know, rebuy, table six. So I rebuy, next hand, pocket eights. I flop a set of eights and move in. And I forget how I lost that one. Somebody might have outsetted me or something later on.
That is unbelievable.
But three in a row, boom, gone.
Oh, my God.
And there's nothing worse than a rebuy tournament than after you've exhausted your rebuys and you're gone. On a hand like that, I mean, I had great hands.
Man.
So I guess I redeemed myself by making it to seventh place in the night tournament later on. But interesting. And the little sit-and-goes they do at Seneca are not bad, too. They kind of, you know, most of the time we talk about the sit-and-goes that they run at Derby or Tampa Bay Downs, and they're all front-loaded at the top with, you know. But the one at Seneca kind of replicated an online version. It was a very flat payout.
Yeah.
55 to get in or 60?
It was 60, and they paid out
250, 150, and 100.
500.
Yeah.
So they took 10 out from each person. So it's a 50 plus 10, basically, which compared to Derby Lane is a great deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not as good as an online sit and go, obviously. But
yeah, it's only 10% instead of 13, or no, it's more than that. Was it 20?
10-minute levels starts pretty low, and by about the fourth round, it essentially turns into bingo, as one of the dealers put it.
Well, the interesting was there's a lot of regulars that played there, and they play some pretty high limit games. While we were there, there was a 10-25 pot limit Omaha game going with a 1,000 minimum buy in.
Wow.
And some of the people in the big tournament I played, the 100-hour buy-in, were talking about how the sit-and-goes just aren't worth their time. Not because it necessarily is not a good payout, which I think it is. It's just, you know, those guys can make that money on a single hand, so why waste your time? But they do run them all the way up to 2,000, supposedly, Although while we were there, they only got two going, and both were $50 ones. But
I'd say of the three rooms, I liked Seneca best. It seemed to be, and we didn't play much at all at Niagara, but between Falls View and Seneca, I couldn't believe it, at Falls View, for example, they've got seven or eight guys standing around in cheap suits and five or six tables with dealers sitting at them with no players, and they got wait lists on the board,
for
giant wait lists for every game.
Why don't they spread more tables?
It's over. It's overmanaged. They have. They must have some sort of union regulations in Canada where they have to have 17 people overseeing everything. Because I saw more guys with clipboards standing around doing nothing at Falls View than I've ever seen in my life.
Wow!
And empty tables with all kinds of wait lists. And we had that 5-10 game where we had to wait about 2 or 3 hours to get into it. Meanwhile, there were 7 or 8 people on the list and empty tables. I said, couldn't you open another 5-10 game? He says, well, we might at 6 or something. You know, he gives me this kind of brush off. But at Seneca, it was a lot more efficient, I thought, and they were more willing to deal with what the customer wanted. When we got shorthanded on the stud, they cut the rake back considerably. In fact, they did no rake for a while when we were at forehand.
Though they did something interesting, too, there. They had enough people on an interest list for 3-6 hold'em, more than enough, actually, and they created another table of 2-4 instead.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
And what I don't understand is a lot of the people that were on a 3-6 list are already in a 2-4 game, so if you would have created a 3-6, not only would those players be 3-6, it would have opened up to 2-4 for people who wanted to play 2-4. But
well, why don't you? I think we all ought to run a poker room because I think we could do it better than anybody.
Absolutely.
I found the dealers to be good, and the other thing I was telling Scott is that, you know, when you go out to Derby Lane, and for people who are not from this area, it's not going to make a lot of sense to listen to this, but they're so anal about all the rules over there. You can't bring your hand across this line, and if you bring chips over, you've got to put the whole thing in, and you can't verbal. They got like 1,700 rules over there. We played in tournaments and live games the whole time. Never had any issues with people. You know, they'd have a stack of chips and they'd like peel a couple off to call a bet. No one had said that you had to put the whole thing in or that that amounted to a raise. They're just, it was a lot more grown up, I think, is the word.
Yeah. Well, and part of the problem at Derby is the players there. I mean, they're kind of forced to respond to the knuckleheads that show up at Derby. Yeah. And there were some knuckleheads where we played this weekend, but they, most by and large, they. Or more respectful.
The guy, the guys that Scott refers to as M&M wannabes. If I had to choose between playing at a table with a bunch of old crusty rocks at that stud game or playing in a no-limit hold'em game with guys with baseball caps screwed on backwards and calling everybody dog and all that, sign me up for the stud game, man, because... But as I was telling Scott, we were looking at the future of stud in that in microcosm. That table, when those guys pass, stud is going to be in jeopardy.
Because
the demographic on the stud table was about 40 years older than every other table in that room.
But the Antiope Nation is doing its part.
That's right.
Mew will inject some youth into that.
Now, I also thought, and maybe this is too bold of a prediction, but I can picture Faso and I, and maybe even you, Chris, 40 years from now, sitting around the hold'em table trying to keep the hold'em game going while everybody else is playing Crazy Pineapple or something like that, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's hysterical. All right, so give me an impression of all these rooms as far as tables. How many were there in each one of these rooms, roughly?
Now, Seneca's website, I believe, said 16, but there had to be a lot more than 16 tables in that room. It was a pretty big room, I thought.
Yeah, I would say maybe 20.
And Falls View probably had about 20 or so.
About the same.
Again, half of them with dealers just sitting there looking stupid.
And then Niagara was smaller. It probably had about 10.
Yeah, probably.
10 or 12. Yeah. And they never had more than two or three tables going at any time when I was...
Well, except Saturday when we got there and the whole place was packed.
Oh, right. Well, when we couldn't get in.
Right. But, yeah.
Wow.
So that's they're not too bad. They're not big,
tables,
but
roughly.
To be honest with you, if you're going to go up there strictly for poker, you'd probably be better off going somewhere else.
Yeah, like the Bayou or something.
Maybe Tunica. Yeah. If it's just going to be strictly poker.
Yeah.
I don't think that Western New York, Niagara is going to be on my list of poker destinations. No. Because, A, it was too hard to get into a game. B, there was one stud game in three casinos. No Omaha, other than that high limit thing.
Right.
And no 4-8. Yeah. Or 3-6.
Now, if you're a no-limit player and you're comfortable playing at higher no-limits, like, you know, 5-5, 5-10, 10-20, then
it's
probably a different thing.
Yeah.
You probably will be able to get in a game pretty easily.
Yeah, Fallsview has the good no-limit games.
All right. But for us limit folk,
yeah,
not really a destination.
How about technologically speaking? Did they have any of these places have the large plasma TVs for the waiting lists?
There's one thing I really liked about Fallsview. I mean, they were the only one that had the big plasma and the wait list where you could see it, which is, I think everybody should do it. I don't know how much it costs. It seems like it's worth it.
Right.
Particularly when we went to Casino Niagara, which was the second we went to, and they still were scribbling on paper there and shouting out. So, but the other thing about Fallsview is all the dealers have a little clicker at their table, and as soon as somebody gets up, they click the button, and it immediately lights
good.
Up on
registers
the wait list.
That the wait list.
So there's none of this seat open table six, and you know.
Did you hear there was a seat open on table
yes,
six?
Yes, yeah, and taking 4 hours to get somebody in the game. So I'll give them that. You know, it took forever to get in the game, but as soon as the seat popped up, you know, you were seated.
That's really good because I know in my visits to Foxwoods, they have all the technology and everything, but when the seat gets open, it relies on the pit boss to scream it across the room.
Right, right.
And then they, you know, by the time it actually gets through the whole, you know, can and rope and can, you know, whatever, and you never get in. So
now
that's
in Seneca, the room was set up a little differently. It was easier to hear the announcer, and they had a whiteboard up there. But that's better than the paper thing. I never trust casinos where I go and there's someone scribbling my name on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing they did do at Fallsview that drove me crazy is they were running around the clock WPT satellites because, you know, the Doyle Brunson's there this weekend. And if you got into a satellite and you got out of a game, you immediately got back at the top of the list of the game you wanted in. So we sat there for hour and a half, 2 hours waiting to get in that 5-10 game, and all of a sudden we went from first in the list to third.
Oh, yeah.
Because the two people in the satellite.
Right away, so I didn't like that. Mm-hmm. But a couple other things that I think that I would love to see, especially the rooms around here in Tampa Bay, pick up. One, at the Fallsview, the dealers, when they took cash in, they immediately took those little chips that have the numbers on them and put them in a place so that the money was always counted. So when they came around to get a fill, they just gave the chips to them, and they didn't have to sit there and recount the money out and go like that. So I like that. And then two, there were how many fills did you think we saw in the one at most?
One at most.
You go to Derby Lane, and those trays are empty all the time, and they have like two brush people.
It slows down the game incredibly. I don't know how they do it. They never. I saw one or two fills in 40 hours of playing cards.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's got to be a way that they
there's
can
something they're
duplicate
doing that works,
that.
And I wish more casinos did it. Cause
well, first of all, they forced you to buy your chips at the cage.
At the cage, which is a good idea, yes.
Which is great. The other thing, as far as the exchange goes, it's very easy. If you go into the Canadian side, you want to buy chips at the cage, you give them U.S. They just immediately convert you
that's great.
To Canadian. And to the nearest dollar.
Very pretty money they have in Canada.
Yeah. It's got the queen on it.
Lots of colors.
Stuff, right? And colors and everything.
And old prime ministers that are dead.
Yeah.
Now, what's the rake when you're at a live
table? The rake was pretty bad there.
It was bad.
It was per hand. It wasn't a half hour or whatever, right? It wasn't
I don't know about the no limit. Well, the 1-2 no limit we played, it was a rake.
The 5-5 no limit was a $6 charge per half hour.
Okay.
The limit game that we played in, what was horrible about it was that you had to take, and this was common up there, they had to take $2 out of the pot every time there was a flop, regardless of the size of the pot.
Oh, man.
And then it was maxed out at 5%.
It was,
or 10%.
10% up to $5.
Which is pretty darn high.
Yeah.
Now, in the 5-10 game, the limit 5-10 that we played in, you had some big pots in there. So it wasn't as bad to see the one red chip go out of those pots. But we played in a 2-4 game for a little while. And they have to drag the $2 out of every pot if there's a flop.
So if it just folds around to the blinds and there's $4 in the pot, it takes two?
If there's a flop, there's two.
If it goes to flop.
If it goes to flop, there's $2 coming out of the pot.
Yeah.
So it'd be $4 in the pot. They would take two out. You'd be playing for you're losing money. You'd be trying to just get your own money back.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. Oh, that's unbelievable.
Well, you'd chop in that situation.
Yeah,
every time.
Right? Yeah, I guess so.
And at Seneca, they did have a bad beat, one of those terrible bad beats.
Quads over quads.
Quads over quads to win it. It was at 24,000, and the old guy say it hasn't been hit since 76, it seemed like.
No, it's...
But it was actually hit last month, but the dealer misshuffled, so it was voided.
Oh.
One of the dealers said that'll happen three times a year, statistically, that there'll be quads over quads.
Well, you remember when we first started doing this show, and I went my first trip to Foxwoods back then, when I saw tens over nines quads. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So when you were saying that the timed one for $6 every half hour, that was Canada?
That was at Falls View, the No Limit.
So that makes sense. That's about $5 American, which is what they charge at Foxwoods.
Now, the stud game, the structure of the stud game was a dollar ante, and one to five. A dollar ante, low card brings it in for a dollar, and then it's one to five at any time.
Wow.
And so if somebody bets two, you can take it to seven
for
the max raise. Or if you want to raise min, you could take it to four. Or anything in between four and seven.
So how about some stories? You guys got some stories from at the table?
Well, I've got one here. You know, I've said this before. I just don't get the whole sunglasses at a poker table, particularly at a $30 tournament or a 1-2 no limit or... Geez, a 2-4 limit.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But twice this trip, I saw idiots wearing sunglasses, misread the board, and cost themselves a lot of money just trying to be cool. The very first day playing the 1-2 no limit, there was this guy, he came, you know, he had the whole TV set up. He had the big dark black wraparound glasses and the big long black leather coat and sat down and he was terrible. But he looked good, he thought. And boy, he got into this, how did I lose that pot? Did he have a queen? No, he had a jack. That was a queen on the flop? And he lost. He went broke. He went all in. Lost on that hand because he misread the board. And then in a tournament later, an old chap with sunglasses looked over and pushed all in with what he thought was a straight and really was an ace high. And then didn't even realize it until they pushed the pot to the other guy and then started freaking out. And it took the entire table like 10 minutes to convince this moron that the board was right, the pot was pushed right. And so
there was also a guy at Seneca. For those of you who have seen The Sopranos, there was a guy at Seneca. I guarantee you he is genetically indistinguishable from Johnny Sack. He's Johnny Sack. I thought it was Johnny Sack. If I had any, you know, I would have walked up to him.
Yeah, but when the old guy's gone, oh, that's Walt.
Yeah, right.
I've known him my whole life.
Well, and the other table, there was a guy that was a dead ringer for
Donald Rumsfeld.
Really?
They could, like, those guys could hire themselves out for birthday parties.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Unbelievable. How about you, Mike? Anything stand out in your mind other than Mario?
Rebuy gate, yes. Well, just one thing. There was a guy at the table. The best player I saw was this guy who looked like Matthew Broderick, a little pudgy version of Matthew Broderick, at the tournament. He was making tremendous reads. It was like you were at a table with a guy at the final table of a World Series event.
Wow.
You shouldn't even have been at that table.
Wow.
He was.
It's the Jamie Gold guy, right?
You call him Jamie Gold. I call him a pudgy Matthew Broderick. And he did an enormous check raise on a guy with an open-end straight flush draw and got the guy to lay down like a big, big hand.
Yeah.
And he just made some incredible reads. And every pot I saw him go after, he took down, even when he didn't have cards. And it was very impressive to watch that. And there were quite a few good players. There were a couple women at the 5-10 table who were very sharp. And then there were the people that you always run into. You know, they'll just tag along and keep throwing in chips and then catch.
Yeah.
And not so much at 5-10 at the 2 as at the 2-4,
yeah,
though.
We got a little facile rage.
I got angry once.
Angry is a small word.
I had Jack 10, all right?
His favorite hand.
And I flopped an open-ended straight. and this is at the 2-4 limit game.
Right.
So I flop an open-ended.
Which he still blames me for dragging him into.
I flop an open-ended straight, and so a guy, and I check an early position, a guy bets, I check raise him, and he calls, and this is some ding-a-ling, right? So I make the straight on the turn. This time he checks to me, I bet, and he calls. The river puts the same straight on the board.
Oh, I hate that.
It gets worse.
Guy down at the one seat with a NASCAR cap on, I believe it was the Harvick team, or I believe, if I'm not mistaken. There's a straight on the board! The ding-a-ling that I was in the pot with, who probably could have laid down the hand if seat one hadn't piped up, checks. And then he says, oh, really? Oh,
God.
And at that point, I can either bet or check, and I'm so disgusted, I just check. And
but before you checked, who said that?
No, I looked at
who's had a straight on the board?
I didn't say that.
Oh, yes, you did.
And the
deal, I thought, had a really good comeback. He all swirled his head in the air, and was like, oh, it was a little birdie.
I said to the dealer, and it wasn't like that at all. I said to the dealer.
You're right. It was probably meaner.
I said, who said there was a straight on the board?
Oh, come on. Who are you, Mary Poppins now?
And the dealer's like, huh? And I said, who said there was a straight on the board? And he goes, oh, it was just this guy over here.
And the dealer did handle it well, I think. I mean, it's a 2-4 game. You know, people are just coming from their home games where they say that stuff all the time. It's not a problem. So, but it is unfortunate. But it was nice to see a little Faso rage there.
I got angry a couple times, but I tried to keep it in check.
Did you insist on a 10-minute warning or a penalty or make the guy get up from the table or did you make him cry?
No, I didn't do anything.
Oh, so then it wasn't like your home
This
game,
is the
then.
Same guy, this one seat, who sucked out on Scott when he had no business being in the pot. He took a huge pot away from Scott in this 2-4. 2-4 game is like a cockroach. I mean, it's just multiplying all over the place. It needs to be stamped out.
Yeah.
We need to get like some bug spray and just start exterminating this 2-4 game because it's terrible for poker.
Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating for me because I won in both sessions at the 5-2. I won in my 3-6 game. Lost a lot in this 2-4 game on terrible suckouts from people that had no business being in the hand. But that's what happens in 2-4. I knew that going in. I was only there waiting for a real seat to open up. And then I did all right in stud the first day. And then, you know, just the monotony of 14 straight hours of it and playing shorthanded, I got waxed in the last day. Yeah. So take away that, and then, of course, the tournaments, which I was oh so close to cashing. I'm trying to find a silver lining in this otherwise brutal trip.
Did you get your complimentary card player magazine from any of these? Any of these guys?
Yeah, Red Bull. That was the other thing that I thought was interesting. In Canada, they don't let you sit in the poker room unless you're seated in a game.
Hmm.
So when you're waiting for a seat, any other casino, you know, like Binion's, you sit down and, you know, you start flipping through bluff or
at an empty table.
Card player at an empty table and you just sit there and wait. And, you know, maybe you're hanging out with a buddy and you're talking. As soon as you sat down, sir, you can't stay there. You have to go to the bar.
Oh, my God.
There's so many regulations in Canada. It's just...
Yeah, you know, a lot of times, too, you get tips from the pros and you read their books and you read their tips online and they say, you know, scope out the game first. Look at the players that you're going to be playing with. Follow them. See if you can get a little... If you can't do it, what's the point?
Yeah. Well, I did that in the 5-10 limit at Fallsview because I came in one behind the button or something and they asked me if I wanted to post and I said no. And... because I wanted to see those nine hands or whatever it was and observe the game first.
Yeah.
I don't like to post anyway. I like to come in on my big blind and I like to leave under the gun. So I'm always paying the minimum in blinds. And you pick up information.
Straight from Chris's heart.
You pick up information by sitting there and watching the players.
Sure, absolutely.
You find out real quick who the knuckleheads are and who the good players are and everybody in between.
Did you pick up any good information in the Card Player magazine? Because I got mine, but I haven't read it yet.
No, I nothing that jumps out. Bluff magazine was more interesting, I thought.
Bluff was good.
I mean, there's not a lot of substance in Bluff, but it was some interesting articles. This Jennifer Lee is all over the place now. She goes by Genocide.
Oh, yeah.
Online Phenom, like 23. She was like in every magazine I read in the last month. So that was kind of interesting to see her take on things.
All right, so I guess the big question, overall, how'd you do?
I'm still playing.
Mike?
I didn't do well.
No.
But I brought a bankroll up there that was – I would be comfortable losing the whole bankroll.
Okay.
And I we both did hit the ATM, though I was pride had enough pride in my game to go to the ATM in the poker room.
That was the thing.
Mike stands up and goes, I'm going to have to hit the ATM. And he disappears from the poker room, and then he comes back, and I see him at the cage. And I'm like, why don't you use the ATM right here?
Because if you use the ATM in the poker room, that marks you out as a fish.
Yeah.
Because you're going to the ATM, and everybody can see you.
Yeah.
So
I wanted people to think I was a fish, because I wasn't.
See, now, I always bring enough that if I go bust, I know that day's enough, because otherwise I'm going to pay that fee, and you know how cheap
I
am.
Yeah, I know. But here's the problem is that when we both had to use the ATM, I think it was your case, too. I know, definitely my case. Half my money was in Canadian at that point. And they don't.
No, I used it at Seneca.
Yeah, exactly. So I was in New York, and I couldn't, you know, they're not going to take a loony.
Right.
So, you know, I had to go to the ATM then. And then I just proceeded to lose it all later anyhow, so it didn't really matter.
And it was funny, too, because at one point Scott hit a three-ooter. I have to say this. I love Canada. I love Canadians. Part of my family's from Canada, and so I found them to be very polite and nice
very
people.
Friendly people, very good
and,
dudes, very nice players.
Nice players, and I have no complaints.
I just wish they learned to play Limit.
Absolutely.
Or Stud, or Omaha, or Crazy Pineapple.
Well,
tried to get a Crazy Pineapple game going one night.
Really?
Couldn't get everybody at the table to go for it.
Man.
And we also wanted to do
and
a
you know
stud.
Who was leading that charge?
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to do a stud high-low at Seneca, but we couldn't get everybody to agree on that either.
Mike would have never played Crazy Pineapple. He wouldn't even play in our home game.
I hate Crazy Pineapple.
So do I. I hate Pineapple and I hate Crazy Pineapple. I used to like it, but now it's just insane.
Yeah.
It's just not poker. It's a lot
big pots, though.
Yeah. All right, well, on behalf of the Antiup Nation, I'm glad you guys are back safe. I was lonely, man. It sucked. I'm sitting here at work trying to message you guys. I'm like, oh, they're not here.
I got my toe stuck in the jet of the heart-shaped jacuzzi in the room, so that cut down on my play a little bit.
I do have to say this. We did have free Wi-Fi access in the hotel room, so I did log on a little bit and play a little full tilt while I was there. Yeah. But,
and you're in Canada, so it's legal.
Yes, that's true. And but the last night we log on, and I hadn't, you know, done much with anything on the web, and I'm like, oh, let's go check out the blog, see how much Chris has posted, and
not a
thing. So I'm like, well, maybe somebody on the Antiup Nation has posted on the forum at least, so I can read something. And we did get quite a chuckle out of El Snarfo's poll.
Poll, yeah.
And
I commented on there. I knew what you guys were doing.
Yeah.
I knew you'd be broke. All right, well, let's move on to our hand of the week. That was a crazy game. It's not really a hand of the week per se. It's more of a hand of the week situation, I think, right? Because
and I think we have a couple other hands to throw in this.
So yeah,
it's
so
a trifecta.
It's like it's a love fest of of laying down hands. I think is what maybe we'll call this one. You know, it'd been a long time since we heard from our good friend Lauren. I thought maybe he was in jail because he plays in those New York
playing
clubs and they're always getting busted. And we hadn't heard from him in more than a month. It seems we used to hear from him every day. So finally today we get an email from Lauren, and he's in one of those 2-5 no limit games, and he comes up for a situation where he wonders if he should lay his hand down or not, and then you guys are in these similar situations. So let's read his hand, and then it'll just be basically it won't be a hand of the week really. It's more of a
situation
of the week.
Yeah, there you go.
SOTW. All right, he says, "Hey guys, it's been a while since I wrote in, but I've been listening religiously." He says. He subscribes to over 50 podcasts and usually has about 10 waiting at a time. But whenever Antiup comes in, it goes right to the top of the list. All right, anyway, so he's got a hand that he wants to submit. He says it's not really complicated. All the action is pre-flop. It's not a bad beat, just an interesting hand. He's playing at a live 2-5 no-limit game with the minimum buy-in of $400. The max buy-in is $650. A full table of 10, and it's pretty loose. Preflop raises of $20 don't really weed anyone out. It usually takes $30 to $35 to narrow the field, and even then you'll get probably two callers.
I was going to say, in the 1-2 at Niagara, most raises at my table were $17 at a 1-2, which I thought was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's the way it is at Foxwoods, too. It's $15. Okay, so he's the big blind. He has about $600. Under the gun folds, and everyone at the table after that limps in for the $5. He looks down and sees pocket queens, so he pops it to 50. This is where it gets interesting. He says, the next guy who is under the gun plus one and has about the same amount of chips as he does re-raises to $150 after limping in for five. Then someone else goes all in for
$350. Wow.
So now he says, you know what Cloutier says? The third raise is almost always king-king or ace-ace. On top of that, an early position limp followed by a big re-raise also screams big pair. And I had two people do it to him. So, in other words, he's got two re-raises. This should have been an easy lay-down, right? Well, not for me. I guess that I'm not that good enough to lay down queen-queen here. Here's how I talked myself into staying in the hand. I don't know much about the initial re-raiser, but the guy who went all in had been down to about $90 half an hour earlier and had pushed all in about four times since then, including with ace-ace 5 minutes earlier. So I decided that they thought I was trying to steal from all the limpers and hoped that maybe I was looking at two tens or jacks from the initial re-raiser and something like ace-king from the all-in. Or better yet, both of them might have ace-king, which, you know, eliminates their outs. So he pushes, trying to isolate against the all-in guy. But the guy still the act calls, and all three of them are all-in. The guy who pushed all-in for 350 shows pocket aces. The other guy flips over the absolute worst hand he can imagine. Queen, queen.
Oh, my God.
He says, ugh. Obviously, no. He said no straights or flushes came, and the aces held up, and they chopped the side pot, and now he's down to 250. The other guy with queen-queen said, I should have folded to the re-raise. Or re-raises. I said the same thing to him. We were both right. Laying down queen-queen is hard, but facing two check raises and the infamous third raise, I should have been able to get away. Maybe next time.
Well, the lesson on that, it comes back to something I heard about a couple weeks ago. Don't get into a situation where you're talking yourself into thinking that what they're holding is the only holding that you can beat.
Right.
You sort of talk yourself into what they putting them on something that you can beat.
Yeah.
And I find myself doing that a lot, too. It's very tempting to put them on a hand you can beat.
Yeah.
And
you Especially with that kind of money out there, and you've committed 50. But he's still got 600 left. At that point, he's either almost out of the game.
Yeah, and he only has, what, 30 invested at the spot?
50. 50. He bumped it to 50.
I wouldn't find that hard to lay down.
No, not at all.
I wouldn't like to lay it down,
right.
But I certainly wouldn't find it hard to lay it down. And that gets into my hand, which happened at the tournament that we were in where they converted to real chips.
Right.
There was a guy directly to my right who was the short stack along with Scott, who was directly to my left. And the other guy who was the short stack had made it clear time and again that he was going to be pushing in as soon as he got a pair, big hand, something like that.
Yeah.
And we'd played about 15 hands. He had entered one pot, but basically had not been doing a lot of anything. Situation then comes up where the guy at the far end, who played like three people after me, was the pudgy.
Jamie Broderick.
Matthew Broderick.
This was the guy who was making incredible plays, incredible check raises. He was really playing well. Huge chip stack. Gigantic. The guy to my right had about $50. I had about $100. And the guy down at the end probably had
$4,000.
No. $250, $300 in chips anyway. Uh-huh. So this guy to my right keeps folding and folding and folding. And finally he comes around and he goes all in. And I look down and I see ace-king. Now, I look around and I think it's pretty obvious that there's not going to be anybody else in this pot except for the guy at the end. If there's going to be anybody to play, it's going to be him. So the guy at the end had been playing a lot of pots and had been winning a lot of pots. That doesn't mean he necessarily was going to have a big hand right here.
Right.
But I was faced with a decision. I could call off half my chips with ace-king, or I could raise to 100 with ace-king, or I could fold. And keeping in mind that I still had the guy with the giant chip stack behind me still to act. So
Would raising have committed all your chips, though? Or did, how much did you have at that point?
Well, if I made it to 100, that would be it. I'd be okay. All in.
Yeah.
So let me ask you. It sounds to me like you're afraid of the guy in the end outplaying you, maybe. But there's no chance I'm outplaying you if you push anyway.
No, well, I don't think it's the outplay.
Well, what is it that you're afraid of?
You'd be up against two cards, two hands.
Up against two hands.
Just with a card that needs to improve.
Okay. See, if I make it 100, it's not going to hurt him at all to call with his giant chip stack,
right,
with a
opportunity to take out two players.
An opportunity to take out two players with a lot of sub-premium hands he could think about calling, okay, because he knows he's got us both all in, and he hasn't committed a large percentage of his, okay, stack.
Yeah, unless he was on a stone steel. There,
so now I'm looking at, okay, calling probably is not going to be an option.
Right.
Raising is an option. But then with the giant stack down at the end, the chances are that I'm going to be up against two other players with ace-king. So I can easily defend pushing all in at this point.
Uh-huh.
However, I really thought I was behind in this hand. I really thought that the guy to my right had a pair. And if he has any pair, it's at best a coin flip. So I laid down ace-king.
Did the guy in the end up calling?
He did not call. It was folded back, yeah, and everybody just...
Pocket tens, the all-in head, wasn't it? Didn't he show?
Did he?
I think so.
All right. Well, I figured I was behind because he had made it clear that he was gonna go all in as soon as he got a pair.
Right.
And he had sat there for 12 hands and hadn't played, and then all of a sudden he goes all in, and I got ace king. So, do I get crippled for a coin flip, or do I go bust for a coin flip against two other people possibly?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it's a bad decision. When I revealed later to the rest of the table that I had folded ace-king, they acted like I was crazy.
Yeah.
And I told Scott, ace-king is a hand that you really need to be careful with. People overplay ace-king all the time. And you're a coin flip against any pair. I just felt like I could pick a better spot. A, I was under the gun. Who knows? I still had a lot of people left to act because I think he did this on the big blind or under the gun or near it. So not only the big stack down there, but I probably had six other people that could have acted behind me. Well, obviously, a raise is going to clear them all out. But
I don't think
so.
You said. What were the blinds? Do you remember?
They're pretty low because I was still in.
They were like
more
five,
than 2-4.
Yeah, I was going to say 4-8 or 5-10, maybe 2-4.
Wow.
So he pushes all in with about 50 at that point. Anyway, I laid it down, and if it was the wrong decision, that's fine too, but I can certainly defend pushing all in with it.
Well, certainly we were up against some very aggressive players, I think, in Seneca, because in the tournament I had a somewhat similar situation. Now, Mike thought it was a very easy lay down. As quickly as I laid it down, it probably was in my mind too, but it was a tough call for me. I was the short stack, probably in the tournament, definitely at the table, and I had jack-jack in the big blind. I was planning on going all in with that hand. The under-the-gun player, though, makes a pretty big raise, and he was a very solid player, but he played a lot of weird stuff. And he was able to. He was one of these post-flop kind of guys that, mm-hmm, could really outplay someone. So I didn't really know what that meant. Again, with jack-jack, I was hoping to be the one raising, not the one calling.
Yeah.
The very next player, who was the second short stack at my table, was very flummoxed by this, seemed really upset because he had a hand it sounded like he wanted to push all in with, thought about it for a while and mucked it. And then the next player, who was playing all kinds of stuff but had a big stack, moved all in blind.
Oh, my God.
Which I thought was hilarious, but this was his reasoning, and I'm not saying I agree with it. But he said he was doing simple mathematics. At that step in the tournament, somebody puts that much money in the pot, it doesn't matter what cards he has, the right call is to push it and try to take all that those chips out of the pot. So then it comes back to me now, and now I'm faced with an all-in that's going to put me all in. I mean, two bets that were more than my stack,
right,
with Jack-Jack. And a hand that I was ready to go all in with just like 5 minutes ago. And, you know, I mocked it and I showed it, which was wrong because...
still had a guy left to act behind
you. Still had to act. I thought the other guy was already all in with the call. So I felt terrible about that. No one really seemed to care, which was good. But I mocked the jacks, and the guy that folded thought that was the most horrible laydown in history. Of course, he had ace-jack, too, so one of my outs was gone, he told me. But... and it turned out the guy who went in blind had 10-5 suited. The guy that made the original raise had ace-queen. The 10-5 guy flopped a 10 and rivered a 10.
Oh.
To take down the whole pot. So I would have been gone.
You'd have been gone anyway.
Which didn't matter anyhow because I ended up not cashing going out in seventh. But I don't know. I think, you know, all these big hands. Now, queen-queen, jack-jack, ace-king. I think those are all easier hands to lay down than aces or kings. But... you know, and if reading Card Player too, in the very first hands of the World Series this year, somebody went broke, ace ace versus king king pre flop.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
You don't
fold aces pre flop ever, but kings could happen.
No, kings maybe.
$10,000
queens are easier to throw away. Ace king is easier to throw away, and jacks are even easier to throw away. So,
yeah, I think Mike's ace king. I think I can't throw that away. I know I got a short stack. It's probably pushing with eights. Ends up being tens, but I just can't.
But you're in a coin flip then.
Yeah, but you know what? At that point, at that stage, he's either got $100, he's going
to
get...
Well, the blinds are still low.
Yeah,
the
blinds
were...
All right, it really could be more than 2-4 there. He had a lot of poker left to play.
Well, if there's a lot of poker left to play...
I'd rather get my hand in after the flop when I have a made hand.
It just seemed like he worried about this guy at the end. If he knew that he was isolated with this guy, he would have called probably. If you knew it was you against him, you would have called.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
And then if you push in your 100, I think even though you said it wasn't a drop in the bucket for this guy, it's still a lot of poker left to be played at 2-4. Is this guy really want to try and knock you out right now with any two cards?
Yeah.
He doesn't know.
I don't. Well, he didn't call knock out this one guy. Why wouldn't he call knock out two?
Well, two you have more pot odds then.
Well, all right, so you have more pot odds, but you have more cards to beat. Why wouldn't he have called to try and knock out this one guy who had $50? With Jack-Jack, any two cards, right? He's a big stack. He didn't call him, so why would he call another guy re-raising it to 100? I just think I have to push there. I don't know. That's me, but you don't know. And it is a race. You're absolutely right. But you look down at ace-king, and you're second short stack at a table. You got to get some chips to make that money. You know, I don't know.
Well, like I say,
but again,
I don't think you were short stack, though.
I thought you said you were second short stack at the table.
You were, but here's the interesting thing about this tournament.
I was at least third short stack and maybe fourth short stack because Scott and this guy with the raised all in were both had less chips than I did.
But here's the interesting thing about that tournament. When you converted the tournament chips into casino chips, the difference between everybody flattened a lot. I mean, I had 45, and the chip leader had, 200 maybe at most?
Yeah.
So you're only, four down, and you were at 100, so you're only, half the chip stack of the leader at that point.
Right.
So,
see, I just can't see that the chip stack, the chip leader, calling 50% of his stack to try to knock out two players. I don't see that happening. If that's how much he had. If he had 600, maybe he, calls.
But still, then you're in a coin flip with the guy next to you.
No, you're absolutely right, but I like my hand with ace-king. Plus, it doesn't have to be a pair. The guy could have ace-jack. He could have any ace.
Well, and that's why you like No Limit better than we do.
Yeah, I do.
Because you like to push, and you can make those reads, and we can't. You know, I like to wait to get a made hand before I...
But it was good that he's looking behind him. That's very important, is look behind
absolutely.
You. You know, but I just... If the guy only had 200, I didn't think he'd call 50% of his stack to try and knock two players out, but...
And we'll finish up with one more story about a read in these tournaments. Because these players in that $100 tournament, I really enjoyed playing it, even though I got terrible cards and couldn't really play. But people were really making reads in that. And, you know, you go to Derby or Tampa Bay Downs, and people aren't making reads. They're playing their hands and pushing. And and I saw a lot of all-in pushes with top pair, with bad kickers, and knocked people out with, you know, nothing. But the one call that I thought was really funny, there was a really bad player, we'll call him Bubba, And his brother was right next to him, who was Bubba 2. And they were terrible, and people were just constantly firing at him, trying to get these guys chips. And, of course, I had nothing to play with, so I was envious. But a guy, pre-flop raise, he pushed on the flop with more, he pushed on the turn with more. The guy in the one seat, who I think was a good player, but got just mesmerized by the fact that this guy had nothing in his hand. And he called all his chips off on the river with ace high. And Bubba had jack six off, and the turn was a six. So he had a pair of sixes. So his read was right on, and that's what he said. Boy, I knew this guy had nothing. But he called with nothing. You can't do that, I don't think. He went home with ace high. And the satisfaction of knowing that he made the right read.
Thanks for playing. Send you home with some parting gifts.
I think we've said that numerous times on this show. You know, you have to have something to call nothing. You know what I mean? You know he's got nothing, but you better have something to
Well, and later in the tournament, the final table of that one, too, somebody pushed all in, and his opponent, and again, these guys know each other a lot, says, God, I know you have absolutely nothing, but I have nothing. Too, and I can't call you.
My nothing beats your nothing. Exactly. Is what I've heard quite a lot. Yeah.
So he was smarter than the first guy.
All right. Well, thanks for coming back safe and sound and giving us another great show. And good luck at the Apes tournament tonight, guys.
Yeah, you too. Don't enter any pots with me, though.
No, I won't. I won't. I always avoid playing against you because that means I'm kind of finishing last. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables. Any Up is engineered by Dave Morrison and is a production of TBT.com and the St. Petersburg Times. If you'd like to write to us, send us an email at poker@tbt.com or call us toll-free at 1-866-371-9605.